You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is coming out on the 25th of August, 2024. And what we're going to do is continue. This is the second and final part of what I did last week concerning Joseph Stalin's writing and policy on ethnicity and nationalism. I have a few things from Lenin and things like that too. But if you remember, I said last week that since so much of the Bolshevik nationality policy came from the desire to refute Austro-Marxism, that is to say the socialists that were headquartered in Vienna right before and right after the war, led by Otto Bauer. Now, if you go back a few years in my archives, I did an entire lecture on Otto Bauer and the Austro-Marxist school, which amounts to a national socialism, because he wants to preserve the nationality issue within a socialist context. His main book, most famous book, is Social Democracy and the Nationalities Question, which came out in 1907. And it's this work and the Brunn program from Switzerland that Stalin takes aim. So Stalin has to redefine and then refine his opinion on ethnicity and nationalism at a fairly early date. Stalin was no theoretician. He was no philosopher. He writes like he's writing a polemic or a pamphlet, which a lot of Marxists do. The niceties of, you know, dialectical materialism, he probably doesn't get into, at least not in any detail. So, and you'll see as we go along, showing Stalin's reaction to all of this, that a lot of his objections to Bauer's National Socialism are illogical, in the sense that he's assuming what he's trying to prove. Now, last week, I showed you that Stalin defined the nation as inherently containing a territory, a physical body of land. Now, since Stalin's nationality policy was so violent, and that was what he was known for when Lenin was alive, knowing where this all came from is very useful. The issue with social democracy and the nationalities question, the Brunn Conference of the Socialist Labor Party of Austria, I think it was called, is that territory is not required. In fact, Bauer defines the nation as the totality of men bound together through a common destiny into a community of character, meaning that there is a genetic component, but he doesn't talk about language or territory. And this, he doesn't mention the state either, but bound together, common destiny, community of character, all imply these things. They do not imply a territory. And it was unusual for a Marxist. And I'm not sure what kind of a Marxist Bauer was. I think he took that very, we'll see here in a minute, he took that very loosely. because Marxism, like capitalism, agree on the nature of globalization, or what Bauer calls naive cosmopolitanism versus internationality. The latter implies that nations exist in their interactions. The key issue with Bauer that Stalin takes issue with is that the reason that socialism has to maintain the national side is that national identity is a vehicle, a praxis for self-determination of labor. In other words, it's content, where Marx only dealt with form. Is it possible that the desire to not be exploited, is that sufficient to not only lead a revolution, but to build a new state? There has to be a positive side to this, and neither Marx nor Lenin give it. So, the issue is the nature of territory. We talked a lot about that last week. Karl Renner's phrase was the personal principle. It's a way of gathering the geographically spread out members of the same ethnic group. So in Social Democracy and the Nationalities Question, Bauer says, the personal principle wants to organize nations not in territorial bodies, but in simple association of persons. And so he is separating the nation from the land and making the nation a non-territorial corporation or community. Bauer saw imperialism as the very opposite of nationalism, that capitalism leads to imperialism. Because, and I'm quoting here, imperialism results from the insatiable and uncontrolled drive of capital to realize itself. Realize itself meaning be in a position to reap the greatest rewards, the greatest profits. And imperialism seems to go with the territory, and we're living that right now. The issue of ethnicity wasn't so much its existence, but that there is a dominant nation that controls the rest, which is what he means by imperialism. You can't be against imperialism and believe that the nation is a myth. His principle, the personal principle, rejects any kind of imperialism, and it also brings the army or the military under these local councils. He says that the religious wars came to an end in Europe when church and state were separated, so to speak. Of course, that's not true, but I understand his point. He says the conflicts among nations could be brought to an end if state and nation were separated. Now, if you remember, many years ago, I wrote in the Occidental Quarterly about the nature of non-statist ethnicities. Now, keep in mind that the rule of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, you know, without a monarchy, is that of territorial unit, but with a central parliament elected by some means, but certainly territorial. In other words, all the eligible voters would be responsible for national issues, foreign policy, military, etc. But when it comes to culture and education, that's where members of one ethnicity elect the council within the empire, no matter where they live. Now, Renner in the Socialist Party of Austria, the country, that is to say, the empire, should be divided as far as possible into regions that speak one language with full political autonomy. But then he also talks about the national register, and Bauer agrees with it. Renner and Bauer say that there has to be a declaration of ethnicity, and that has to be part of a registry in multilingual districts. National communities are going to be realized by voluntary consent of one individual after another. the whole point of nationalism in Bauer's mind is that under imperialism, only a small strata of the population can be a part of national culture. He wants to bring it to labor, in other words, to the vast bulk of the population. So you have a communal identity, and then, of course, you have a territorial empire-wide identity. One is territorial, the other is not. Now, the party he represented, the Austrian Social Democratic Workers' Party, I misspoke before, this was in the last decades of the existence of the empire under the crown, you did have some ideas concerning non-territorial rule. There was an example in 1905 in Moravia, the Moravian Compromise, and that doesn't have to do with ethnicity, it has to do with income-based, what they call curias. Those were divided into Czech and German sections since they did not get along. So to ensure that Czechs chose representatives of their own nation and the Germans the same thing, the voter lists were ethnicity-based as well as income-based. You see it in Bukovina, Galicia, 1914, even Bosnia, after its annexation by Austria. That, of course, had to do with income. It wasn't based on nationality, but it was based on religion. So there was no territory for this. There were local constitutions. Members of any ethnic group or religious community to elect representatives to a local parliament, forming its own corporation. However, these examples didn't offer economic autonomy. Now, I want to quote the Brunn program, which is something that Stalin brings up quite a bit as laying this out. But it also acknowledges that their peoples can only achieve any cultural progress through close solidarity with one another, not via petty disputes, that in particular the working class of every tongue must adhere to international comradeship in arms, international brotherhood of the interests of each individual nation, as well as in the interests of the collective whole, and that their political and trade union struggles must lead to unified cohesion. So, the ethnic principle relies on membership, not territorial residence. Now, the Austrian case, 1918, was different than the Russian case, certainly. Bauer didn't believe that the Bolshevik Red version of revolution could ever occur in Austria. Because, as many of you know, you had the Bavarian Soviet Republic, the so-called German Revolution, and, of course, Bela Kun in Hungary, which I've also dedicated an entire show to many years ago. And none of them lasted. Now, Bauer was Jewish, didn't think this should be extended to them. But Bauer was well aware of the Jewish nature of the Hungarian Soviet Republic, and is aware that's one of the main reasons that it fell apart. Bauer was not a Bolshevik. He was an advocate for labor within the ethnic context. In fact, Bauer's, the Social Democratic Labor Party, or I should say Workers' Party, usually would turn over Bolsheviks to the state. They wanted to distance themselves as much as humanly possible from Bolshevism. The fact that the Austrian state is in Central Europe, not Eastern Europe, makes Bauer a bit less optimistic about an actual Red Revolution. And he also makes the claim, and little did he know this was going to torture the Russian Revolution, but the division between peasants and workers in the urban areas are divergent. It wasn't so much, you know, that any peasant wanted collectivization. They just wanted their own land. And, you know, the hinterlands, Alpine hinterlands, the Church of Rome, was very well represented and fairly popular. In other words, he wasn't about to impose all of these things onto a people who didn't like it. And he certainly wasn't going to explain it away. We'll get to hear in a minute what Stalin has to say about it. Remember, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was dismantled by the Allied powers. He didn't think that any kind of Bolshevik movement, or even if they took over, could ever defend itself. It was, there's such a tiny percentage of people in Russia. And it wouldn't have any real support in either the peasantry or the urban working class. So social democracy, in his case, the gradual reforms from the bottom up, is for him the most feasible method. Granting major concessions to the working class without civil conflict. That's where the Austro-Marxists did much better than elsewhere. Bauer also didn't like the idea of the vanguard party, something that Stalin, you know, that was his whole thing. That this is an organic movement, not a vanguard movement, and that it's going to slowly realize itself so it can adjust, especially to rural areas. And this, that itself was a departure from the international. That whole party hated, and the quote, the dictatorship of caste over the masses. That, I think, comes from Gruber's work. The caste was the party that in the Soviet Union claimed to be the sole spokesman of labor. Labor abstractly. Now, as always, you had a core of intellectuals in all of these socialist parties, which was Jewish. But, of course, Jews were deeply divided at this point. That's what they mean by urban intellectuals. And that developed. But it wasn't supposed to stand. And members of this party, one was the mayor of Vienna, engaged in substantial reform. That gave them a certain optimism. The Soviet Union, as the years went on, did not give these guys any kind of optimism. So, moving to Stalin, the Austro-Marxist Bauerite idea is national autonomy, or a conception of the nation, as Stalin would say, a union of individuals without regard to a definite territory. Nations are autonomous unions of persons. Bauer talks about the community of persons, and it doesn't have, according to him, exclusive sovereignty in any particular region. Now, Stalin notes that it's often the case that members of an ethnic group don't live all in one geographic location. They are spread out, they're dispersed, and they're dispersed among different countries and different regions, the same ethnic group. Now, Stalin seems to think that it's a critique of this, to say that capitalism drives men from the countryside into the cities in search of work. But when they come to foreign territory, and they, of course, become a minority, they're made to suffer by the majorities there, restrictions on their language and schools, etc., hence national conflicts. And that's why, again, this is Stalin kind of summarizing them, that's why territorial autonomy is unsuitable. And that's how the minority problem is to be solved, as well as how the labor problem is to be solved. Stalin seems to suggest that this automatically means that members of these unions would be of different classes. And, of course, that's not Bauer's intent alone. One of the party members, Springer, and I'm going to quote him here, "Hence the necessity to organize the nationalities to invest them with rights and responsibilities. Of course, a law is easily drafted, but will it be effective? If one wants to make a law for nations, one must first create them. Unless the nationalities are constituted, it is impossible to create national rights and eliminate national dissension." Bauer made the claim that the working class demanded ethnicity, especially minority ethnicities, to be instituted in public corporations. And this is Stalin's first question. How is a nation to be organized? How is one to determine this? Now, Springer talks about the registry, certificate. Every individual living in a certain area has to declare his ethnic affiliation to one of the nationalities of that region upon reaching voting age. So on the basis of the free declaration of adult citizens, national registers will be drawn up. All the Germans in nationally homogenous districts and all the Germans entered into the national registers in the dual districts will constitute the German nation and elect a German national council. And the same applies to Czechs, Poles, and all the rest. So the national council, this is a cultural parliament. This is where all of those bodies are represented. But for each ethnicity, they have rule over education, national literature, national artistic movements, etc. And that's the organization of the nation, at least in mechanical terms. Stalin, again, assumes that these are interclans. And he quotes Bauer that the purpose of all this is to make national culture the possession of a whole people and thereby unite all the members of the nation into a national cultural community. And that, according to him, can occur unless the labor problem is solved and exploitation is eliminated. Bauer wasn't much of a Marxist in that sense, but he certainly was a socialist. He also thinks that this should be a global idea, that all nations, that all countries can use this. He's separating nations from states, so we have to say country. So the council governs all members regardless of where they live in the state. It's membership over territory. But Bauer is speaking of the working class, because even Stalin will admit that national power politics for the majority class is something protecting the property classes. And one of the demands against this is a demand for national autonomy. Now, Stalin's big criticism is that there's a big difference between national autonomy in Bauer's sense and self-determination. In other words, the fullness of the nation is brought about by socialism. That kind of ethnic autonomy is a part of labor's emancipation. And Bauer was smart enough to realize that the state is not going away under Marxism. Stalin then tries to parody him, claiming, and rightly so, that these ethnic autonomous units will serve as a prototype of a future socialist society, the positive content as well as the negative content. That humanity will be divided this way as it's always been. That doesn't mean it's not international. He says, socialist society will undoubtedly present a checkered picture of national unions of persons and territorial corporations, and that is a higher synthesis of nationality than the self-determination of nations as a chunk of land. Nationality in this sense is not alienated like it would be in the national state, and therefore ethnicity could be a part of a just society. When labor is free from exploitation, this makes a lot more sense. Labor is embedded in the ethnic principle. It is a popular principle. In rejecting this, this is one of the foundations for Stalin's desire to destroy nationality. Because one of the many things that capitalism and Marxism have in common is this belief that economic growth will eventually eliminate nationalism. Of course, they were wrong on both counts. But Stalin claims to believe in self-determination of nations, not the national autonomous system. Of course, Stalin doesn't answer the question, self-determination based on what? Is it just the borders? Is it the titular nationality? On what grounds are you self-determined? And Stalin says here, number one, that this Bauerite school, the cultural national autonomy, presupposes the integrity of this multinational state like Austria. Self-determination, according to Stalin, goes outside of that. It doesn't imply that the Austrian Empire, whether with a crown or not, should continue to exist. And second, self-determination gives a nation a certain right of sovereignty and political sovereignty, whereas national autonomy endows it only with cultural rights. And that's a big argument for Stalin. The nature of internal and external conditions concerning irredentism. What's irredentism? This is where an ethnic group that's divided between two or more states wants to unify all of its members into one body. And the irredentist problem is very common, especially in the Austrian Empire. Bauer says this is inevitable for the proletariat of all nations. I mean, irredentism is really a red herring. But what happens when he mentions the Ruthenian Social Democrats wanting to unite two parts of their people into one whole, in the Hungarian side and the Ukrainian side? What happens then when it's over the border? Which, of course, is an irrelevant question. Stalin says that this is a Procrustean bed of the integral state. And sometimes I wonder if Stalin knows what that means. A Procrustean bed is where the bed is of one size. And if you don't fit, if you're too tall, you get your legs sewn off. Sort of. That's what the myth is about. And just the opposite here would be the case. The autonomy would be the opposite of a Procrustean bed. Territoriality, because it's these quantitative borders, that would be an example of it. Nations are cut down to live within their borders, and that's the principle of nationality. Now, Stalin says that there's no doubt that in the early stages of capitalism, nations became more self-conscious. But the higher and advanced stages of capitalism, dispersion sets in, where you have all kinds of out-migration, in-migration, and so everyone is dispersed. Everyone's looking for a livelihood, and they're settling in other regions of the state or elsewhere. And it's from that they lose their connection to the home ethnic group. They even could go so far as to develop new tastes and possibly even a new language. But this is exactly what the theory is trying to avoid. And he suggests, of course, and Karl Marx said the same thing, that free trade and liberalism are anti-national. And that's why the anti-national idea is necessary for Marxism. Stalin isn't very rational here. He says, is it conceivable that, for example, Germans of the Baltic provinces, the Germans of Transcaucasia, and elsewhere, can it be united into a single nation? Stalin says this is a utopia of the old nationalists, turning back the wheel of history. Now, of course, Bauer sought the union of Germany with Austria, but the Allies vetoed it. Again, the assumption is that everything is moving in an anti-national direction. And Stalin doesn't give us an explanation as to who the old nationalists were and what about them is specifically utopian. So the point he's trying to make is that the unity of a nation diminishes as a result of migration. And according to Stalin, it also will be diluted given the nature of the class struggle. Now, that's a fallacy because there's no reason to believe that class struggles contradict the national ones. They can, but there's nothing inherent to it. Stalin's idea is that as large-scale industry develops, and of course imperialism develops, that's when the class struggle becomes more and more acute, and any commonality, any common culture, begins to melt away. But of course, Stalin doesn't understand that that's the point. There are no commonalities between owners and workers. Even if they say that they're members of the same nation, this is precisely the problem that Bauer's trying to solve. There can't be a common destiny. If, for example, the upper classes declare war on somebody, but the workers don't want it. He assumes that this is an interclass national union. It is not. And it's precisely to avoid the fact that the way that rulers enjoy the national culture versus the workers, who really can't enjoy much of it, that's the problem to be solved. Stalin's argument is that national autonomy is inherently contrary to the class struggle. Part of the Marxist conception of nationalism is that this is the result of the bourgeoisie using these ties to paper over their irreconcilable differences with their own labor. And yet the bourgeois elements have always been anti-national. What Bauer's talking about, this form of national socialism, is to heal the split such that labor is the sole and complete possessor of the national idea. So either Stalin doesn't understand that, or he's being dishonest. And he's complaining about, you know, the nature of these social democrats, which of course was the early socialist terminology, that the class struggle will be overlooked in this ethnic intensification. And yet Stalin says, any social democratic party has one purpose: to organize the proletariat, to organize labor. And with the national idea, it's going to be a distraction from that. They have to organize this and reimagine this ethnicity as an autonomous matter, rather than just have it be the negative rejection of exploitation from the laboring classes. The laboring classes, of course, being so, it's pretty much, you know, in theory, it's anybody who doesn't own productive capital. They work on it. They have to sell their bodies. But that could go everywhere from intellectuals to farmhands to factory workers. So even there, within labor, you have such radical differences. Why doesn't that militate against class consciousness? But I'm not sure what Stalin is talking about here. Is he talking about income or capital ownership? You know, the rich don't necessarily have to own capital. But Stalin goes so far as to say that if you accept the autonomous point of view, you must abandon the class consciousness to take the path of nationalism. And which is an assumption, and his assumptions nullify his argument. Those two things are not contradictory. So these demands, Stalin says, place the Austrian Social Democratic Workers' Party in the nationalist camp, not in the socialist camp. And Stalin says, well, if we can't use the national autonomous idea today, then it's not going to be any better in the future. But, of course, this implies that Stalin's argument is correct in the first place. Since this is about a free laboring class, hence creating non-alienated ethnic councils, Stalin is in no position to say what happens after socialism is imposed, or even what happens when labor is free from its obligations to owners. Stalin said, Bauer's prophecy regarding the division of humanity into nationally delimited communities is refuted by the whole course of development of modern human society. National barriers are being demolished and are falling down rather than becoming stronger. But that has been the capitalist matter. That's the job of free trade. The implication is that socialism requires the destruction that capitalism wreaks on a society. Bauer is saying that the waning of the national idea is a bad thing. It's the result of free trade. It's the result, therefore, of alienation. And when all said and done, it's this destruction and alienation is a product of capitalism. Stalin quotes Marx from his early writings in the 1840s. Marx says that national differences and antagonisms between peoples are daily more and more vanishing, and that the supremacy of the proletariat will cause them to vanish still faster. But capitalism had the effect, given its colossal growth, of reshuffling, that's his word, reshuffling nationalities, and that you have a free union of people, not peoples, people within even larger territories. Stalin, in his attempt to preserve the class idea, wants to reject anything that isn't based on class, despite the fact that Bauer's idea of these national councils exists only when labor is free. It's conceivable that he thought that these were vehicles of revolution. You know, nationalism, it inherently seems to be socialist. A nation is non-individualist, yet the market is completely individualist. And Stalin says that these national unions are meant to be a substitute for socialism rather than something to help bring it about or help justify it. That when this has been tried, and he doesn't mention any examples concerning the history of socialism, every attempt like this contains the elements of inevitable failure. But Stalin then points to himself, that this is my opinion, that the national principle is substituting for the socialist principle of the class struggle. That nationality is inherently a bourgeois development, where, as far as the owners of capital are concerned, are already internationalists. They're already globalists. That's what imperialism is. They have colonies all over the world. The point of these bodies is to remake the nation, where it's the property of everybody, an inherently socialist idea. So Stalin accuses him of masking this nationalism with various socialist slogans, and this is why it's harmful to the proletariat. This is a surreptitious kind of nationalism, a concealed nationalism. And because it's put forth in collectivist or the communal terms, it seems to be made more palatable to socialism. Clearly, with all the writing that both Lenin and Stalin did on this, this is a pretty substantial threat. I mean, if nations are disappearing, then why even bother with this? Stalin says this is going to create mutual distrust among workers of different nationalities, which, of course, is the capitalist idea of bringing the third world to the first world. And hence, low-wage recent migrants are competing with citizens, white citizens. They have nothing to do with each other. They don't have a community of interest. But the answer to that is that repressing nationality also creates segregation. Nation, not class, is the locus of rebellion. And the Soviet drive is to define what these things mean. I want to quote Bauer here from his The Question of Nationalities and Social Democracy. This is a later work, 1924. He says, "It is not from capitalist imperialism, but from proletarian socialism that the working class expects the realization of the political unity and liberty of all nations. Like every form of society before it, the socialist social order will completely transform the principles of the formation and delimitation of the polity. It will destroy the forces inherited from the epoch of feudalism and early capitalism that still sustain the multinational state. It will divide humanity into nationally defined polities that, in possession of their means of production, will freely and consciously control the development of their national culture." Now, Stalin is right to say that, and he believes that what Bauer has said here is very harmful. He says it prepares the ground not only for the segregation of nations, but for the breaking up of the united labor movement. It creates the psychological conditions for a division of the United Workers' Party into separate parties built on national lines. But of course, Stalin's nationality policy, once he took over the Soviet Union, is far more violent than anything that he's talking about here. So he must mean the destruction of nationality, because one trade union will have different nations within it. But it doesn't necessarily imply that there's going to be complete segregation. He seems to suggest, again, the assumption is you have to have one or the other. He doesn't either want to or he can't understand the connection between the content of socialism and its form. The form is class. The content is national. And what Stalin doesn't seem to grasp either is that these are part of the same society. The non-territorial principle it coexists with the territorial principle for broader legislation. Not to mention the fact that it makes Soviet control over these movements a lot more difficult. Stalin claims that after the Wittenberg Party Congress in 1897, the Austrian Social Democratic Party began to break up, and their breaking up became more marked after the Brunn Policy Congress, which adopted national autonomy. He says that there's a problem because the Czech Social Democratic Party won't have anything to do with the German Social Democratic Party. Stalin has a problem with not being able to dictate to a single party. And what happens in a revolutionary situation? It's still part of the same society. There's principles of unity, and there's certainly principles of division. But no matter what conception of nationality you have, these divisions are still going to exist. You cannot force them together, as Stalin will later do. These hatreds, and they're not making it up, it's for legitimate reasons, which he doesn't even address. They're going to divide trade unions, you know, because they're living in such close proximity. They're not being, you know, Stalin would ship an ethnic group away to a different place and then bring the local ethnic group to where they were removed from, deliberately mixing up the nations. Of course, he doesn't say anything like that here. Now, Stalin says that Czech workers will go so far as to break a strike of German workers. But he doesn't ask why. The why doesn't change. National autonomy or the Stalinist point of view, the Orthodox Marxist point of view, the division still remains. So Stalin, from all of this, says that national autonomy has nothing to do with revolution, is the opposite of revolution. The national question is important. This is what Lenin gave Stalin to do. But Stalin may be talking about himself here, because this principle seems to aggravate and confuse the question by creating a situation which favors the destruction of the unity of the labor movement, fosters the segregation of the workers according to nationality, and intensifies friction among them. But that friction exists no matter what point of view you take. It assumes that socialism and capitalism together will destroy nationhood, and they have not done that. Now, in Stalin's The October Revolution and the National Question, which came out in November of 1918, we were talking about a different text before, as I said last week. This is a different one. And it's the difference between the February and October revolutions. The February was the Menshevik one of Alexander Kerensky, the more or less liberal one. And the October was not a revolution. It was kind of a coup. No one else was there. The opposition was so divided. But, you know, the Bolsheviks were a tiny minority party. They just simply were the best organized. And as far as the February Revolution is concerned, the bourgeoisie took over. Now, the October Revolution, according to Stalin, came from the workers and peasants who wanted to put an end to the war and to secure peace. But the provisional government is the February Revolution, was dedicated to continuing the war, which, by the way, is also true. But it does imply that the bourgeoisie was out of power when the monarchy existed. Now, Stalin talks about the economic disruption of the country. And this is 1918. The food crisis. Stalin says it demands the expropriation of capital and industrial establishments for the benefit of the workers, which, of course, never happened. Confiscating the landlord's land for the benefit of the peasants, despite the fact that the peasants were the landlords. Stalin accuses Kerensky of guarding the interests of the landlords and capitalists, resolutely protecting them against workers and peasants. Two groups of people, by the way, that don't have a lot in common and certainly absolutely don't have a unity of destiny. Stalin was naive enough to not realize that the peasant wars and massive peasant uprisings against the Leninist state were just getting ready to break out. That so long as the war continued, you had economic disintegration and the breakdown of the food supply. Which is not true. It was only after Lenin took over in Petersburg and then moved the capital to Moscow. Then their policies, because of all the uncertainty, like all revolutions do, they lead to civil wars. Famine was spreading through the country given explicit Leninist dictates. Now, on some kind of pseudo-intellectual idea, the February Revolution, according to Stalin, was a contradiction. Because while it was a revolution, it was a bourgeois revolution. And that may be true as far as it goes. And then the Kerensky government was incapable of solving the basic problems of the economy or the revolution. What he doesn't say is that these problems developed only because the Soviets took over as much as humanly possible. Soviet policy caused the problems that he says Soviet policy is going to solve. Stalin calls it the overthrowing of the landlord and bourgeoisie, these parties, and replacing it by a government of workers and peasants. Therefore, there is no contradiction here, as if to say that workers and peasants have the same interests, which is absolutely not the case, and Stalin's going to learn the hard way. He says that the landlords were omnipotent, and the rich peasants were violent, and that problem was solved, according to Stalin, by handing over the land for the use of the laboring masses in the countryside. Not the ownership, but the use of the laboring masses in the countryside. Prior to this, of course, the peasant commune was the dominant institution, and the peasants themselves, to 95% of the available land in this area, were owned by either peasants in communes or peasants by themselves. I've said this before in all my work on the Bolshevik Revolution. Stalin says that right after the October Revolution, mills and factories were expropriated and given over to the workers. Well, that's equivocation, because by worker, he means his party. Most of his party were not from the laboring classes whatsoever. They were very Jewish. They were urban. They were from the merchant classes. They often came from the wealthy. Stalin then prides himself as being a confidant of Lenin, where Finland was recognized as independent. That's what Soviet power did, rather than it being a fait accompli, given that early on the Soviet power was weak. Now, I've been through this in great detail, what the grain requisitioning contingents did. Farmers weren't getting much for their produce, so any surplus was not being handed over except by violence. But at this point, Stalin says that the Bolshevik Party was confronted by the regional governments and national councils. He's talking about like the Ice March, the Don region, the Kuban region, even parts of Siberia. And of course, somehow in Stalin's mind, the Cossacks are bourgeoisie, or bourgeois, which is absolutely laughable. That these national governments were, according to Stalin, bourgeois by nature, and they weren't going to destroy the old bourgeois order. Instead, they thought it their duty to preserve it. And of course, you know, Stalin doesn't say anything about their economic program, that they just wanted power, as if Stalin didn't. Soviets were running the very early USSR, and starvation had already set in, and mutual hatreds were intensifying. That these national governments along the border regions declared war on the Reds in Moscow. And once they declared war, they became, according to Stalin, hotbeds of reaction, despite the fact that the White Army generals, very few of them were actually landowners. At least the White Armies were pan-Russian. They weren't necessarily national. It's different in the Baltic states, parts of Central Asia, the Caucasus, Poland, Ukraine, among other places. But that seems to suggest that nationalism is popular, not unpopular. So Stalin claims the October Revolution will solve these ethnic problems by destroying the national bourgeois governments on the fringes. But there were few workers in these border areas because there wasn't a whole lot of, especially in the south, urbanization. And that these ethnic governments were very popular, especially with their own working classes. So when Stalin says the bourgeoisie, he's talking about all anti-Soviet elements, regardless of their economic program or their economic position. Here's what Stalin says. The fight of these border governments is depicted by some as a fight for national emancipation against the soulless centralism of the Soviet regime. So he says this in kind of a mocking way, and he says it's quite untrue. And he says, no regime in the world has permitted such extensive decentralization. No government in the world has ever granted to the people such complete national freedom as the Soviet power in Russia. And the problem is that while it was highly decentralized, that's only because the Bolsheviks were very weak. Remember, free trade is international, not national. The early Bolshevik state was fairly weak, especially as the Civil War was getting started. It wasn't their policy. It was something that was forced on them. And the only way that the so-called workers were to take over in these places is if the Red Army took it over. And of course, he gives a whole saw about the Western aid going to the whites, which is nonsense. And somehow this connects the national state with imperialism. And there is nothing to suggest that the bourgeoisie ever wanted anything national. Stalin still hasn't mentioned any of their economic programs. Then he starts talking about oppressed nationalities, that they could only be liberated with a rupture against imperialism. And I don't know where he sees this, oppressed nations. So either the ethnic units are good or bad. They can't be both. There's a difference in both Leninism and Stalinism between great and small nations, but these are seen relative to the Russian majority. But what Stalin doesn't understand is because he's redefined the word bourgeoisie to mean anything that's anti-Soviet, no matter what your point of view is. But the true bourgeoisie, the owners of capital, were violently opposed to any kind of nationalism. They were both internationalists. Now, I want to switch gears and go to Lenin. Lenin wrote a contribution to the history of the national program in Austria and Russia very early on. And again, this is an earlier criticism of the Austrian Social Democratic Party and the Brunn Congress. Lenin does point out that the autonomous ethnic principle was voted down there, and he's right. It was. But let me quote from this program directly. Every nation inhabiting Austria, irrespective of the territory on which its members reside, shall constitute an autonomous group which shall quite independently administer all its national affairs. That is to say, language and culture. The point being, and what Stalin doesn't understand, is that their competence was part of the decentralized agenda. There, of course, is a territorial principle, but it has nothing to do with ethnicity. So Lenin says the state is to perpetuate the creation of these nations, an educational and similar thing, and each citizen can register with any nation he pleases within the local pantheon. And allegedly, this is on page 82 of the minutes for the meeting, not a single vote was cast for it. And many of the Stalinists said that this is chauvinism. But regardless of that, this was the meeting where this was laid out. And so these are self-governing regions within a given nation shall form a single national association. That's the nature of autonomy. Now, Otto Bauer, who was mentioned by Lenin, talks about the Jewish variation of this, and that both Lenin and Stalin talk about the Jewish Labor Bund as being the promoters of this. Now, as far as Otto Bauer's book, he has an entire chapter where he rejects the cultural national autonomy for the Jews. Now, Lenin claims that the Marxists stand for full freedom of association, including the association of any national regions. Now, some of the more Zionist entities in Russia adopted this extraterritorial position. But that very movement was rejected by Bauer and the Austrian theoreticians. The Jews were not to enjoy this. They were a very different situation. And their book was The Forms of the National Movement, which came out in 1910. But those supporting this kind of autonomy amongst the Jews, amongst the Bund, wanted a two-state solution at this early date in the Middle East. You know, as early as 1910. And what Lenin seems to suggest is that, given the nature of old Russia, you know, late imperial Russia, and where it was on the scale of revolution, you know, quote-unquote backward, that even Marxists are infected with the bourgeois nationalism. Now, Bundists like, you know, Goldblatt and others in the Second Congress in 1903, but their meeting back then, the Bundist Goldblatt calls it the Freedom of Development for the Nationalities, which Lenin says is a pseudonym for cultural national autonomy. But that was completely rejected. And in fact, the fight against the Bund led to even further nationalism, especially in the Caucasian regions. Bolsheviks alone condemned this movement. Even Plekhanov talks about cultural autonomy as something opposed to political autonomy, and that anybody who accepted ethnic autonomy had fallen under the hegemony of the Bund. And yet Bauer and the Austrian school refused to allow to extend this principle to the Jews. They were not an alienated caste, given their preeminence among the moneyed. This was the nationalist minority, the Jewish population, and this is why Lenin and Stalin condemned them. The only ones to adopt the autonomous program were the Jewish Socialist Labor Party, the Belarusian Hromada, and the Georgian Socialists and Federalists, and the Left Narodniks, and the Polish Frasi. I think I'm pronouncing that right. And the Russian Left Narodniks were opposed to any kind of compulsory legal association of nationalities. So Lenin says this is a Bund plan, but he also says that Bauer didn't accept the Bund plan. But so what did Stalin mean? What does all this mean as far as he goes? Lenin said this in 1922. It is quite natural that in such circumstances the freedom to secede from the Union, by which we justify ourselves, will be a mere scrap of paper, unable to defend the non-Russian from the onslaught of that really Russian man, the great Russian chauvinist, in substance a rascal and a tyrant, such as a typical Russian bureaucrat is. There is no doubt that the infinitesimal percentage of Soviet and Sovietized workers will drown in that tide of chauvinistic great Russian riffraff like a fly in milk. So equality of nations was absolutely vehemently opposed by Lenin. The Reds were inherently anti-Russian. Their self-determination for everyone but them. Lenin thinks, for the proletarian, it's not just important, but absolutely essential that he should be assured that the non-Russians place the greatest possible trust in the proletarian class struggle. To ensure that, Lenin says, it's not just formal equality. He says it's necessary to compensate the non-Russians for the lack of trust, for the suspicious in the insults to which government of the dominant nation subjected them to in the past, which is nothing but red propaganda. Russians aren't even allowed to rule Russia by the time Stalin took over. That the only nation that Lenin supported were small nations that were swallowed up by great ones. The great ones were bad, the smaller ones were good, regardless of the economic program of either one. So let me summarize all this. This is what Stalin said in 1913, and this is going to bring it all full circle. At this difficult time, social democracy had a high mission: to resist nationalism and to protect the masses from this general epidemic. For social democracy, and social democracy alone, could do this by countering nationalism with the tried weapon of internationalism, with the unity and indivisibility of the class struggle. And the more powerfully the wave of nationalism advanced, the louder had to be the call of social democracy for fraternity and unity among the proletarians of all nationalities of Russia. And in this connection, particular firmness was demanded of the social democrats of the border regions, who came into direct contact with the nationalist movement. And that summarizes the Stalinist polemic against the nations. That somehow social democracy is internationalist, as capitalism is. Internationalism means that the class struggle could be the only variable in this equation. Yet the national groups then and now remained very popular. But they were bourgeois by definition in Lenin and Stalin's mind, regardless of their economic position or their economic policies. I want to go back and stress the idea that Lenin talked about the use of the land, not the ownership of the land, by the peasants. Of course, he doesn't say that the party's going to own everything using the state as their vehicle. He doesn't say that. It's almost like the Reds had a magical way of thinking that if they said something enough, it would be true. And they don't often, in these writings, give a lot of evidence. Now, the Jewish question here is an interesting one. It didn't go anywhere. But Lenin's position is that the Bundes, the non-Soviet Jews, but they were still Jewish nationalists, were allegedly interested in the freedom of development of all nationalities. And the Zionists, of course, saw this to be the case in the Middle East, at least back then. But the Jews were not an oppressed minority, according to Bauer, that they did control a huge amount of capital. Therefore, they're not really a part of this. And he spends a lot of time on this. So because the state is not unified, there can't be, there's a statutory recognition of national associations within the state. Now, anything that takes control out of the central power's hands is a bad thing. So if anyone is worried about their power, it's the Reds. And it's interesting that Lenin and Stalin's critiques are very similar. Yes, we know that the early USSR was heavily Jewish, but they saw the Soviet Union as the national autonomous movement of Jews. And then later Bitobizdan under Stalin, which I dealt with many years ago in another capacity. So that's the nature of these critiques, and that's the nature of Stalinist nationalities. A lot of it is the criticism of stuff that's been put forth. He doesn't even define self-determination, which is what he accuses Bauer of ignoring. Remember, Marxists don't really believe in anything that isn't primarily economic. That's the fundamentals of the entire theory. Again, the question is, can a movement be based on just this negative appraisal of capitalism? They rarely, if ever, talk about the future society and what the subject of the nationality will be. We know what Stalin did, and no matter what he did or how violent it was, he wasn't able to dislodge the national principle. But given the kaleidoscope of nations within the Austrian Empire, this was really the only way to accommodate everybody. And it's a vehicle for non-alienated labor. It's not to be done immediately. But it is possible that these kind of associations will bring about the revolution, and property owners, that is to say, owners of capital, will not be allowed to stand. And I'm glad I quoted Lenin on Russia, because you see this in Stalin, you see this with everybody. Russia was the enemy of the USSR. Because of its size, if it gets ideas that are not class-based or not party-based, but if it's based on Russian ethnicity, then the revolution is in trouble. And they were well aware of that. Therefore, they had to be repressed and exploited. And I talked about that in the Leningrad purge a few weeks ago. So this is the Bolshevik critique of national autonomy and the development of their own ethnicity policy. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.